Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhutang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I've remembered to do the Namo Tassa today. I think because of what Lumpur said yesterday. 90% of the time I seem to forget. At the end of the 3 months rains retreat, all the community members give a little talk and Lumpur picks names out of a bowl, so you don't know when you're up. And anyway, I forgot again to do the Namo Tassa. It wasn't until I exited the hall or something that I went, oh. And then because I forgot, Beth, who's another long-term lay person, she was before me, and then she had doubts about whether she should have done it. So we all have our way of picking things up and looking at them, and you can be guaranteed that everybody's mind is taking it a little bit differently. But after Lumpur, I thought, oh, I've got to remember to say it. So recently, it was in the summer, I forget exactly which month, but His Holiness the Dalai Lama celebrated 80 years, and Shambhala-san put out this very lovely edition, completely dedicated, articles dedicated to the Dalai Lama. I've always found His Holiness incredibly inspiring, and from the get-go of my practice, just his presence. Before I even had learned anything about Buddhism, I was in Tibet and saw the devotion that the Tibetans had for him, saw his pictures. And there's something in me that always was drawn to Tibetans anyway, but his presence is very special for any of you who've had the opportunity to be in the same room with him. But there's one article in there that I was reading, and the writer is, he goes to Tibet, but he's giving a little bit of background. I think it might be the writer who wrote In Exile from the Lands of the Snow. But he's giving a little background on His Holiness's life. And if you, so when he was 3 years old, the Lama seeking the reincarnation of the, I think it was the 13th Dalai Lama, were led to the province in Tibet where His Holiness was born. And there were various signs, and you can read about that if you're interested. But he was taken as a three-year-old and shortly thereafter taken to Tibet, and his life changed forever. He was no longer in a rural setting. He was protected. He was trained in a way that most children would really struggle with, and he had his struggles. I remember reading he would hear children playing outside, and for him, they had his brother, who was a year older than him, be with him a lot, to be schooled with him, so he at least had someone his age. But often he was kind of by himself, and it was a very lonely existence. And then when I was reading this article, it's the first time I actually read this person that was writing the article had interviewed people that were around at that time or that had direct contact. And when His Holiness was a teenager, he actually had a lot of anger. And when you hear that, it's kind of not the image that we have today. And he struggled. He struggled with these teachings that he had no choice. This is what was being given to him. I think he had very strict tutors. His days were regimented by his mentors. So I remember reading that he enjoyed when he went to the summer palace because sometimes he would get to tinker a little bit with watches and things, but I'd never heard that he really was kind of pushing back, and he would just get angry, get frustrated. And at one point, I guess his mentors were a bit concerned that what if he can't rise to this one? What's going to happen? And then at the age of 15, the Chinese were making their presence known in Tibet, and there was a lot of pressure. And they decided to take this very unworldly teenager, and that it was time for him to also become the political and religious leader. So imagine at 15 years of age, living a very protected life, and suddenly you're having to go to Beijing or wherever it was they had the meetings to represent your country and your people. And because he didn't have any worldly background, then he turned to the training that he had. That was his compass. That's what guided him. And then he really took it on. And that's what created, really, that urgency, that necessity is what created the being that we all see as the Dalai Lama. And I find that really inspiring. I mean, obviously there was something special in him to begin with, that he could take those teachings on and he could turn to those teachings, that he found himself in that situation, and that as a 15-year-old, he could rise to that and take that responsibility. But I'm sure all of us have had things that have pushed us in a way that's kind of left us with no choice but to turn to the practice. And those moments are a really wonderful thing to reflect back upon. You know, this is by no means to any scale like what His Holiness had to face, but in my own experience, I can pick out certain times when there was just really nowhere else to turn. And, you know, they're not any, I could tell you the stories and you'd think, so? But at the time, there was a lot of pressure. I was really confused about what to do. And there was really nothing else to do but breathe, just to try to not push it away, just to try to accept how I was feeling, and to accept that I just didn't really know. And that's the best I could do at that time. And these are actually, I find, they don't happen a lot, but they're kind of another type of peak moment in our practice. Because they force us into something that perhaps we kind of hold back from. When there's no choice and you have to trust in that practice, then that's it. That's your compass. Where in many circumstances that arise in daily life, we're able to find little distractions and things that maybe cover over that feeling of dis-ease, that lack of trust in our ability, the feeling of uncertainty because we don't necessarily know what to do in a situation where maybe we have to make a choice. And it's hard. It's hard to learn to trust ourselves, to really trust what we've been putting in, the retreats that we've done, the readings that we've done, the amount of unfathomable hours that we've sat on a cushion being with our mind, the patience we've had to drum up, the anxiety we've had to sit through, the pain, the restlessness. So just in putting ourselves in that situation, like the Dalai Lama, we've got the resources. They're in there. And then we just have to remember that they're there, because we're not always going to, most of us aren't going to get asked to be the political leaders of our country. thank goodness. but there's, we're going to be asked other things that are going to be equally challenging to us in the moment. We're going to get a call that it, you know, that your mother's going on hospice care. And even, you know, that happened to me. I saw it coming. And the bottom still fell out. But there's nothing to do but to trust in the practice that we've been building up and to take our steps forward with as much mindfulness as we can muster. Because we never know the next thing around any corner, around any... We never know what the next thing is going to be. Two people already had to leave the retreat from unexpected circumstances. And I'm sure when they were arriving here, they were pretty certain they were going to be here for 10 days. So what we're doing here is just we're building our resources. We're sharpening the blades. We're remembering the different tools. We're being reminded of the different tools. We're getting a lot of talks and guidance. And as Lumpur was saying, yeah, it's not like any of this is new to any of us, really, but we do forget. Kind of tuck it away somewhere and forget where we put it until we have no choice, and then we hopefully find it again. So I always find I like to give people pep talks. I don't know why. The other reflection that was coming up for me was kind of this being a monastic retreat, and the question came up as to how, what makes it a monastic, why is it different, how is it different? And it's been a long time since I've taken any other kind of retreat as well. But I live in a monastery, and I'm not a monastic. I'm what's called an upasika, so that means one who draws near. And I've drawn about as near as I can. And I've chosen to live as close to that life as I can as part of the monastic community. And I mean, most of you I know, but not everybody. So it's been, in January, I'll have been there for 18 years. And I still forget my resources. And I live in a monastery. And there's times I forget. So, but what... I just thought I would share a little bit about what inspires me and what drew me to want to be so close. The first retreat that I took was taught by monks. It was in Thailand. And then I was on my way home via England, and so I got names of the monasteries in England and ended up at Amaravati in Chithurst. So I ended up, again, in a monastic setting. So that's kind of always been my experience. And I've always found it very rich. And probably one of the biggest challenges for me, and I think it's a really important one to speak because I suspect I'm not alone. One of the challenges was always kind of undermining my own practice because I wasn't a monastic, and it's the monastics, and then it's me. But actually, if you just can put that down for a minute, if you have that, some don't, but you realize lay people are part of the fourfold Sangha. And living in a monastic community, the presence of lay people is essential to the functioning of the community. So the monks can't cook food, they can't handle money, they can't... They can drive on the monastery their little vehicles, like Lumpur is saying, he has an electric vehicle. But they don't go driving into town when they need to. They receive what's offered. And so the lay people of the Anagarikas, the Samaneras can still, they take it as a training not to cook and things, but if it got right down to it and they had to, they could by their rules. But it's a community, so we're all in it together. We're all supporting each other. And I find that's a really important thing to remember. The monastics take on a training that's a bit more rigid and defined as far as rigid, maybe that's not the best word, but it pushes them a bit more. They have to push their edge a bit more. They're giving up their ability to dress in the clothes they want to wear. They have to, especially in this culture, they have to wear sabongs or a skirt. And, you know, most of them aren't used to walking around like that. We live in a hill. You have to walk uphill. You have to learn how to walk uphill in something that's more binding than a pair of trousers. I wear trousers. but I have that choice. I remember a monk in England once told me, he said, the monastery's a pressure cooker. So people take this training on, and they're stepping into the pressure cooker. But if they stay it out, what comes out are beautiful diamonds. So they're constantly having to refine, or constantly having to push against that sense of me and mine and what I want. And that's just before you even start talking about living in community. That's just taking on some of the rules. And yeah, I find it quite inspiring. I find it really nurtures my practice. And I choose to live there for that very reason, because it also makes me push my edge a little bit. And I take on some of the rules of just being at the monastery, so the 8 precepts. And I've always found those extremely useful. I try to follow the routine as much as possible. Sometimes there's something going on, maybe won't stay up till 3 o'clock on the wanpra or something, but I've certainly done it many times. You push against what you think you can do and what you think you can't do. You define new limits, because we're always setting limits. We seem to always kind of hold ourselves back a little bit. And then you have to push through those. Something will come up and you have to push through it. And there's also this sense of community, because you're living with people who share similar aspirations. And that's a rare thing in the world. Even if you're with people that you wouldn't, if you had a choice, you wouldn't choose to live with, because maybe certain things push up against you, rub you the wrong way, but you share the aspiration, and that's invaluable. So I'm sure, I mean, I come on these retreats, and often it's people that are familiar to me, but new faces. You never know exactly how it's going to be, but inevitably what happens is there's a feeling of community. This is our community. So at the monastery, people come. They come for the day. They come and offer the meal. They leave. But they're still part of the community. That's part of the functioning of the monastery. The monastery's a place for training for monastics, but it's also a place for training for the lay people. And it's just up to the individual how much they want to draw into that and take that on. One thing that I've always been inspired by is watching the new members come in. So they have to come for a period as laymen, and they come for a week and see how it fits. How is it? A lot of times there's a lot of idealism. Just like we look at the Dalai Lama and we think he was always like that. He was always the most warm, compassionate person. So people look at the monks and there's a lot of projection going on. And then the reality, so come and take a week, see how it is to be on a schedule that's not your own, to be have the work monk will assign you to something that maybe you really don't want to do. It's good. It's really good. And then they come, if that works, they come for longer, and usually they have them stay for up to at least 3 months, to really start to get a feel, and they start to get a little bit more responsibility. So they start to carry a bit more as members of the community. So they're starting to get a sense more of being a more functional part of the community. And sometimes there's pressure. A lot of times the lay people, Anagarikas, they end up in the kitchen. And the kitchen is the hotbed for training, believe me. Because people are coming in and out, they have lots of ideas about how things should be done. And you get to hear everything. You get to hear it all. It's a great training spot, and it can also be a place of many, hopefully, inner screams. I'm sure sometimes they get out, those screams. You're with other people, and we all have our opinions, and we're pretty sure our opinion is right. And then if that 3 months works out, then they really feel that they're benefiting from it, they can request to go into white. So I watched people come in. I remember being at someone's house with a couple of monks. It was Lumpur, and I think Ajahn Suchita was visiting. And we were at the treasurer's apartment, and he had tea set up, and so everything was offered, and the monks got their tea first, and then they went and sat down, and the rest of us got our tea. And so we were just sitting there, and he was a layman at the time. And this layman was sitting next to me, and I noticed that Lumpur had finished his tea. And so after a moment, I went over and I said, "Oh, Lumpur, can I offer you more tea?" And so, yes, we went over and offered the tea. And when I sat down again, this guy said to me, he goes, "How did you do that?" I said, "How did I do what?" And he said, "How did you know? How did you know when to ask?" That's what I see. That's a small thing, but what you learn when you live in community like that, and it's that relationship of respect and also that recognition of what we're able to offer, what we can do. You start to rise to that. You start to pay attention, and you start to notice things. So you notice that the flowers on the shrine are starting to look bad. You notice that the candles, one candle went out or something. Or you notice that the Ajahn ran out of soy milk on his tray. And this person is a monk now, and he's one of the first ones that notices some of that stuff. I see him, he's watching. So it's just kind of like honing your skills, your observation skills, taking you out of kind of this dullness that we tend to envelop ourselves in. And it's invaluable. It's something we all benefit from. And it's something, you know, we benefit from with our families as well if you take that training on. I think probably mothers or fathers who stay home with their young children, the really young ones, probably get some of that because you have to be attentive. You don't have any choice. But a lot of what we do in life, we can kind of slip into this dullness, and we don't have to be attentive. And we have to keep reminding ourselves, "Oh, right, sharpen that blade. Keep it sharp." And I find even I've lived at Abhayagiri. I mean, I've been involved from the beginning with the monastery, because I was one of the founding board members, and right away my buttons were getting pushed right and left. I'm working with a group of people, none of us really knew how to do this. There were no Ajahn Chah lineage monasteries in California to draw on for as a resource for how to do things. How do we do this? People had very different ideas of what they wanted to do, and I had spent a year in England. About after I left Asia, I had already had plans as a buffer to go to England and visit with a friend, just to kind of transition from Asia back into the West. And I felt it would be good to do. It was still something that wasn't quite home, so it would be helpful. Then I took this retreat, and my world kind of turned upside down in some ways. And I just was desperate to try to understand what had happened. So I ended up spending about 10 and a half months between Amaravati and Chithurst. And in that time, I started to get a better handle on it, get a little more confidence in my own ability to go back to California. But then once we got back there and we decided, I got a phone call. And it was like, we're trying to get a group together to start something in California. We had no idea what we were doing. So, and there were no monks right here to talk to. So that was a process of growth and you really get a chance to see this bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, this becoming energy and this kind of this annihilationist energy. It's kind of like they kind of seem to bounce off of each other. So when I would get really upset with whatever was happening, and I'd just be, and believe me, I have a lot of stubbornness and I have a lot of opinions. And when I would get really frustrated and upset, okay, that's it. I'm out of here. I'm done. Vibhava tanha. And I remember once going to Lumpur Sumedho was teaching a retreat, and I had left a board meeting with kind of saying, you know, I did my 2 years, and that's it. I'm done. And then I was talking to him, and I had some time to really like let that energy go. And I said, well, this is what happened, and I'm not quite sure it's the right thing to do, and what do I do? And he said, well, just don't leave. It's like, oh. It's like, wow. Why did he have to tell me that? But we need that sometimes. It's very humbling, this practice. And so, you know, I've just being in situations where you're pushed to some things you don't like, and being in a form will push you. Even you know you're going into it, and it's still going to be moments where it just things are aligned in a certain way, and it just really irks you. I remember going to Lumpur Cha's cremation, and I was going to stay at Wat Banana Chat. And I was really looking forward to it, and I knew, you know, I had the little poop sheet that told me everything I needed to know, and knew that when I went there, women would wear a white blouse and a black patum, which is like a sarong, but it's black. And I actually found that kind of relieving because packing was easier. It was, you know, it was just less to think about. And so I got there and kind of got settled and found out where I was going to be. And I went and changed and put on the black patum and the white blouse. And I was walking over for tea. And I don't know where this came from, but this voice just went, who the hell do they think they are telling me what I should wear? And it was kind of, whoa, where did that come from? And that happens. That's what you put yourself in a container and you're going to get that. And if you don't put yourself in that container, you might not see some of that stuff. So it's, you know, pick up some challenges that push you toward that edge a little bit. After that, it wasn't any problem. Then I had to struggle with being in a different culture. And so when women, we don't do it here so much because this is a different culture, and most people don't understand Buddhism to begin with, but there, if you're talking to a monk or especially a senior monk, and the woman would get down and on her knees and be an Anjali, she wouldn't be standing there talking to the monk. And I used to sit there, and it was like a bob. I'd go, the dialogue in my head just drove me nuts, but I couldn't stop it. It'd be like, well, I'm not talking to him. I don't have to get down like that. I'm not talking to him. And then I'd go, just get down. So I'd start to go down. I'd start to go down, and then the voice would go, but I'm not talking to him. I don't have to do that. And it took a while. And I finally, it was just so darn painful, and it was just like, Debbie, you're in Thailand. Just do it. Get over it. And then it actually became something that the perception shifted, and what I perceived was a very beautiful gesture. It wasn't me, a woman, like bowing down to a man. It was me, a lay person, being respectful of something that's to be respected. And it took on a whole different context. And actually, what came about was a lot of joy. Now, I can't tell you that every time after that, that's how it felt. But that's what it is. That's what we push against. That's why we take these trainings on. And we shift our perceptions. We work with those. That's what we have to work with. Until we're enlightened, we have to work with our conditioning. We have to work with our perceptions, how we perceive things, how the memories that we have that make us think certain in certain ways, and or what's, you know, it just, there's many factors, many layers. But we don't have to believe it all, and we don't have to invest a lot into it. And I think it's learning to push against them, learning to put yourself in certain situations that might help reveal those silly little things that we hold so tightly to, that really help us to lighten up a little bit, to really take this teaching to heart and find the joy in it as well, and laugh. I mean, I can laugh about this now, but it was really very painful when I was in Thailand doing the Bob. It was just this struggle. And, you know, being at Abhayagiri and being there as a laywoman, I've been involved with the beginning, as I said. And then when I went to live there, all kinds of things popped up that I didn't anticipate, because all of a sudden I was challenged into how to make that work. So I challenge all of you. When you're with monastics, when you come to the monastery, how can you make that work in a way that supports your practice? I have found it an incredibly rich resource, and difficult, very challenging at times. But with a little honesty, and there's a, I mean, you're here. There's, you know, it's not easy sitting in silence for 10 days. With your mind, making the effort not to talk, not to reach out too much. It's not easy. But there's a reason we're doing it. And I would go so far as to say that there's an element of faith, that we have faith in something. And by doing this, we reinforce that faith. And so that's what draws us to monasteries, is it's a safe place. It's a place where we're supported in those aspirations. We all can share similar aspirations. And what other way is there to live? We can take them back. We can take them into our workplace, into our families, not in a way that we're trying to convert or preach, but you take them in your behavior. Let's really encourage that if there's discomfort. You know, when I used to come to the monastery, you know, the monastery was started in June of 96, June 1st, and I was still living down in Mountain View working for a land surveyor down there, but I was coming up every weekend whenever I could. And every time I got to the West Road exit, my heart would start beating really fast and really hard, and I would almost break out in a sweat. That's the very same feeling that made me give up ever any thought of being a teacher. I went and got a teaching credential, and through the whole teaching credential process, every morning I woke up in a sweat with my heart beating, and I just couldn't take it. But I could take this because I didn't have a choice. I knew this was where my heart, it was like this thing on my heart pulling me, and that's what pulled me to live there. to want to be near. So many of you come and utilize the resource as much as you can. But if there's ever that hesitation, that kind of fear, that discomfort, that's okay. That's to be expected. And there's even a remote possibility. I mean, in fact, it's not remote. Most of that fear comes from our sense of self. It took me a long time to realize a lot of that fear was, what am I going to lose? What am I going to have to give up? What part of me am I going to have to give up? And that can be pretty intimidating sometimes, because it's kind of this willingness to open and to step into that uncertainty through that faith. But we have the example of our monastic community, and believe me, these are things they have to face too. I've never gone into robes, but I can imagine that as soon as you put a robe on, there's already some idea of how you're supposed to be. And it's not an easy thing to do. I have a lot of respect for people who take it on, really take on the training. But as I said, it's our monastery. So just like this to me, and maybe not everybody feels it, but to me it feels like this is our community right now. And we support each other in our practice. We support ourselves by being here with other like-minded individuals who decided to take 10 days out of busy lives to spend mostly in silence, not eating dinner, not being able to choose what we're going to have for breakfast or lunch. I mean, we're well taken care of, so it's not like there's been a lot of suffering, but it is a change. It's a change from the regular routine. And just in that, I'm sure the ego gets challenged, just changing the routine and being willing to do that. So keep it up, team.